Where did we leave the Buddha and Subhuti? In the park. In New York, I shouldn't stay there. Subhuti had just asked the Buddha a question, which was, you know from your homework, you know, how should bodhisattvas live, practice and think, okay? And then the Buddha gives his answer. And it's pretty long, and he says, Subhuti, try to think of every living being there is. You know, try to think of every sentient creature there is. And then he says, very importantly, he says, try to think of anyone we call a living being. Okay, he says, try to think of anyone we call a living being. And then he says, he describes all the kinds of living beings there are. He covers them through what we call the four kinds of birth. And then he says, you should focus on those living beings and you should wish that they could reach total nirvana. He says, Yongsun Yangin Le Dao. You should try to bring them to total nirvana. And he sort of takes a breath and then he looks away and then he turns back and says, and by the way, when you do that, there won't be anybody who reaches total nirvana. Okay. All right? The Buddha says, Subhuti, this is how you should think. Try to get everybody to total nirvana. Then he describes what a sentient being is and who's called a sentient being. He says, your job is to get them to total nirvana. And then he turns around and says, by the way, when they get there, nobody will get there. Okay. Sometimes I think that's why these sutras are so popular, because they can be misinterpreted so easily. You know? They're so mystical, you know. So we have to talk about each part of that. It's what is it to wish somebody to get to total nirvana? Who is it that you're wishing could get to total nirvana? And what the heck did the Buddha mean when he said, when they get there, nobody gets there? Those are, I think, the three things we have to cover this afternoon. Those are the three things we want to work on. The whole process of focusing on every living being and then wishing that they could get to total nirvana is called bodhicitta. In Tibetan, we call it techen semke. Say techen. Senke. Teichen? Senke. Mm-hmm. I'll start out by explaining bodhicitta, which is the Sanskrit for a similar word. This is called Senke. Chang Sem. It's been translated as bodhi mind. Bodhi means bodhi, or Buddhahood. And citta means mind. Okay. And I think, first of all, this, I'll talk about a lot of misconceptions that people get when they hear the word bodhicitta. I think sometimes, I mean, I remember when I was first studying and people said, oh, it means bodhi mind. And then you think, wow, if you get that, you must be a Buddha because you have a Buddha's mind. That's bodhi mind. It doesn't mean that, okay? It doesn't mean the state of mind of a Buddha. There are some words missing between here, okay? It means the state of mind where you hope to become a Buddha, all right? The state of mind where you're wishing to become a Buddha. Okay, so that's the first thing you have to remember. It doesn't refer to the mind of a Buddha. It says Buddha mind. It doesn't mean that. It means the state of mind where you're hoping or wishing or wanting to become a Buddha in order to help others. Okay, I think that's the first thing to say about it. In Tibetan we call Semke. Sem means mind. Sem. And ke means to develop something, okay? To develop something. So this means developing the mind of enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, okay? And then techen, tek means yana, and chen means maha. So techen is yana maha. No, mahayana. Mahayana, okay? The great way, the greater way, where you're working for all other beings, okay? There's a lot of problems with this word, and I think it's good to talk about it because you'll get confused. I used to get very confused. There's a lot of problems here. First of all, why do they call it Mahayana? I mean, isn't it Mahayana already? I mean, if you have bodhicitta, aren't you Mahayana anyway? I mean, bodhicitta is what makes you Mahayana. Wanting to help all other beings is what makes you Mahayana. So why do they call it the Mahayana wish for enlightenment? This is because there's two other wishes for enlightenment. There's three kinds of semke. There's three kinds of bodhicitta. described in the scriptures, especially in the older sutras. And that refers to trying to get to the nirvana, two nirvanas of the Hinayana. There's two lower nirvanas, and then trying to get to full nirvana or full enlightenment. So that's why they add the word Mahayana. There are other kinds of bodhicitta. There's three kinds of bodhicitta. The two of them are Hinayana. One of them is Mahayana. So they say Taichin in order to say, we're talking about Mahayana. Okay? We're talking about the Mahayana wish for enlightenment. There's two Hinayana wishes for enlightenment. The enlightenment they're wishing for is not total enlightenment, and that's why they call it Taichin Sankhya, Mahayana bodhicitta. Okay? So that's the first thing I think you have to say. I'm going to give you the definition of bodhicitta according to Jampa. Who's Jampa? Maitreya, okay? The coming Buddha, the next Buddha, all right? Who, according to tradition, is really already enlightened, and he's... Well, it depends on which school you're in. But anyway, he gave this definition in Abhisamaya Alankara. This is the text for the perfection of wisdom that we study in the monastery. When you get to the monastery, first you do a touch of logic, and then you do 12 years of this book. This was written down by a Sangha, spoken by Maitreya. It's called The Ornament of Realization. Okay. And in that book, Maitreya says, it's a little long, but it's good to know. It's the definition of bodhicitta, and it's spoken by a Buddha, so it's very useful. Say, Semke Pani, Shendun Chir, Yanda Zope, Changshu De. Okay. Semke Pani means bodhicitta is. Okay, Semke Pani means bodhicitta is. Shendun Chir means for the sake of all other living beings, for the sake of others. Shendun means for the sake of others. Chir, for that. For the sake of others. Yanda Zope Changchuk De. Yanda Zopa means totally total, and Changchuk means enlightenment. So total enlightenment. Okay. Yanda Zope Changchuk. Samyak Sambuddha. De means to wish for that. Okay. To wish for that. Tibetan syntax in English is backwards, so reversed. So what it means is, going from the back, bodhicitta is the wish to reach total enlightenment for the sake of others. Okay, and that's Maitreya's definition, so it's probably all right. Okay. And that's Dzogchen Changchuk De. Classically, there are two focuses here, and you can already sense them. One is that you're focusing on total enlightenment. They have to say total because of that thing I said before. There's two lower enlightenments that are not really enlightenments that you can have bodhicitta towards. Those are Hinayana. So they have to say total. So you have two focuses. One is that you're focusing on enlightenment, and the other is that you're focusing on all other living beings. So really it's a state of mind in which you have two focuses. Because there are two separate focuses going on, and essentially what we call two mental functions going on, we have to call it bodhi mind, bodhicitta. Chitta refers to the main mind, to the raw consciousness of the whole mind. Chitta refers to the whole mind. So calling it bodhi mind is a little unusual in English. You don't say, I have a mind to go to Boulder Creek this afternoon, or something like that. You don't say, I have a mind to help all sentient beings. It's like, I have a thought, I'm thinking about helping all sentient beings. You have to say mind, you have to call it, it's called bodhicitta or mind, because there are two focuses. There are really two mental functions going on at the same time. One is focusing on enlightenment, and the other one is focusing on all other living beings. So, to get all those two thoughts in one state of mind, they call it mind, citta, instead of calling it a thought. Okay, and that's a little hard sometimes. People get confused. Bodhi mind, it seems like my whole mind has to be bodhi, you know. Can I have bodhi mind while I'm going to the bathroom or something? You know, because I'm going to be focusing on something else also. And the answer is yes. Okay. In other words, your mind has those two focuses. Sometimes it's called dunya dembilo, which means the mind with two focuses. One focus is primarily for yourself, which is the focus on enlightenment. Okay. I mean, you're focusing. When you say enlightenment, I want to reach enlightenment. The trick is that you are concentrating on something for yourself. When you say for the sake of others, then you're concentrating on something for others. And that's a big point. Choni Dakpa Sherib, when you read it, he'll make a big point about it. He says, what it means is, the point is that the best way to help others is to do something for yourself, which is to reach enlightenment. Okay, the way to help others is to become perfect yourself. Like, as you get closer to reaching nirvana yourself, you get very close to some kind of threshold, and at that point, it occurs to you that you have a choice. You know, you can either cross that threshold yourself, or you can turn around and start thinking about other people also. You know, you can start focusing on other people also. And if you're on the Mahayana track, if you're a Bodhisattva track, as you reach that threshold, you have to start thinking about other people also. Your idea is, okay, I will become enlightened or I'll reach nirvana. But in the back of your mind also is that I want to help other beings. I'm going to reach nirvana so that I can be an example that other people can follow. And when I reach it, I'll really know how to teach it to other people. Because before I reach it, I don't really know how to teach it to other people. So the focus is on becoming, reaching perfection yourself in order to help other people seriously. And that's the point of Senkei. That's the point of Teichin Senkei. Okay, so it's really defined as, you can think of it as two states of mind going on in one mind, one main mind at the same time. Focusing on enlightenment and wanting to help other beings. Okay. As you get closer to nirvana itself, then there starts to become a question, you know, am I going to help other people or am I just going to reach this myself, you know? And the answer is, reach it yourself, but have in the back of your mind that you're reaching it so that you can be an example for other people and you can teach other people. When you get there, you can teach them with authority because you've been there. And that's bodhicitta, Teichin Senkei. The second part of that answer by the Buddha was, do it for every living being. And then the Buddha goes through listing all the kinds of beings. And he talks mainly about the four kinds of birth. Okay, there are four kinds of birth in four ways that you can be born. All right, and these come from the Abhidhamma Kosha. They're mentioned in the Abhidhamma in the third chapter, something like that. And they have described the four ways in which a being can be born. The first one is called Gongke. Say Gongke.
Gongke.
Gong means egg, okay? Gonga or Gong means egg. So Gongke is the first means by which you can take birth. You can take birth from an egg. Okay? Gongke. The second one is called Nyalke. Say Nyalke.
Nyalke.
Nyal means the womb. And ke means to be born. So Nyalke means to be born from a womb. Third one is called Trishe Le Kepa. Say Trishe Le Kepa. Trishe Le Kepa. Tru means warmth. And She means wet. And Trishe Le Kepa means born from warmth and moisture. Okay. I think in the Middle Ages they called it spontaneous generation or something like that, you know, where it's summertime and the weather reaches a certain temperature and from all the pools of water all these mosquitoes show up, which we know to be gonke, egg birth, but anyway, but if you didn't know that, it would look like Trishe Le Kepa. The fourth kind of birth is Zute Kewa. Say Zute Kewa. Zute Kewa. Zu means like a miracle. Like miraculous birth. Zute means you just pop up, you just show up there. I like to call it finished birth or complete birth. In other words, there's no process of going through a childhood. There's no womb, there's no egg, there's no warmth and water. You just show up there and you're totally complete already. You just show up there as an adult. Finished, completed. Okay, that's Zute Kewa. It doesn't mean what miraculous birth means in the West, okay? It's just Zute Kewa. Like Padmasambhava was supposed to be Zute Kewa. All bardo beings are Zute Kewa. When you die and you're born into the bardo, you don't have a bardo mommy and a bardo daddy. You just show up there, and you're as complete the first day as you are on the last day. You just show up in the bardo, and you're already complete. It's sort of a miniature form that's very difficult to perceive for humans, and you just show up there, finished. A hell birth is also zutakyawa. When you take birth into hell, the process is like that. You just show up like being beamed down from the Enterprise, you know. And you're just standing there, and suddenly you're just in hell, and then people are already starting to beat on you, or cut you, or stab you, you don't have any moment to figure out where you are. You just show up there, and suddenly someone's beating on you or stabbing you, and you're trying to fight back. And then your whole life there is like that. It's a big struggle. Like from the very first moment, you have no idea how you got there. You don't know why people are beating up on you or killing you. And you just show up there and people are, right away they're beating on you. And you're immediately reacting and responding and trying to beat them back. And it goes on for thousands of years. It's just thousands of years of struggling against other people and trying to kill them as they try to kill you. And that's a hell birth. That's a zutakyawa. Most humans are nyalke, as you know, womb birth, but not all. And you can read about that in the text. He covers all the different kinds of beings in that way. He also covers all sentient beings from the state of point of mind, point of view of their ability to conceptualize. There's some kinds of realms, like our realm, where we live on very gross conceptualizations. Like to be able to eat food, for example, and to smell and to taste food, it's a very gross and low form of conceptualization. As you get higher into higher realms, that ability drops out and your mind becomes much more finely tuned. And you're pretty much, anytime you have any kind of thought, you go into meditation. You can't have gross conceptions like eating food and things like that. You can't even move much in the very higher realms of samsara. So the Buddha goes through all the possible kinds of conceptualization. He goes through all the possible kinds of birth. The reason being that he wants to cover all the possible sentient beings. Okay, he goes through those lists in the sutra because he's trying to cover all sentient beings. He's trying to say, don't just focus on people around you. Don't just even focus on the animals in your realm. Try to imagine that there are two other realms going on. They're full of sentient beings, and you should think of them, and you should imagine that you're going to be trying to help them too. The reason you want to reach enlightenment is to help all the beings that you can see, and then a lot of beings that you can't see, and you have no imagination that you could ever, that they even exist. I mean, I can't prove to you that there's a form realm and a formless realm. We are in what's called the desire realm, and you don't really become sure of that until, for example, when you reach the path of seeing. One of the realizations you get on the day that you see emptiness is that you really are in the desire realm, and there really are other realms. There are two other realms that we can't see, and they're chock full of living beings. And they're also suffering. They're also having these three kinds of suffering. At this point, Dr. Shaduk mentions the three kinds of suffering. And I think we'll go over them just very quickly. Say, dunya ki dunya. Dunya ki dunya. Okay. Dunya means suffering. Ki means of. So what does dunya ki dunya mean? Suffering is suffering, okay? This is the one that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out, okay? This is the first kind of suffering that all beings have. I shouldn't say all beings, there's some that don't have it. But anyway, most beings have. It's called dunya ki dunya, suffering of suffering. The example in the scripture is the sensation of a backache or the sensation of a headache. That's dunya ki dunya. It means outright suffering, obvious suffering. Okay, it's what you and I call suffering. It could be mental or physical. Okay, either kind. And that's dunya ki dunya. This is a feature of our realm that you get from time to time. You don't have it all the time until you get older. Okay. Say, gyurwe? Dunya. Gyurwe? Dunya. Gyurwa means change. Dunya means dunya. Okay. Suffering of change. This one is really nasty. I mean, to put it simply, because we have a long way to go this afternoon, because we still got to get to the hard part, which was how come nobody gets to nirvana when you put them all in nirvana? Very, very simply, there's no good thing in your life or my life which will not change into something bad. Okay? There ain't nothing about your life, about your normal life, that will not change into something bad eventually. Okay? There just isn't anything. There's something innately defective with the good things in your life and my life. There is no pleasure that you and I can enjoy which does not eventually lead to suffering. Period. That's a little tricky. She asked, what about Dharma practice? That is an exception. Alright. I'm talking about worldly, okay. But it is an exception. It says Lama Tope Dujinam Sakche Kanja Deda Lasanam Kundu Gebagir. That's the Abhidharma Kosha first chapter. And he says, Lama Tope, except for the Buddhist path. Everything else is suffering. suffering and change. The example in the scripture for this one is the taste of a good dinner. Okay? The pleasant sensation of a good dinner. Okay? But it doesn't matter. And the depressing part is that there's no pleasant thing, there's nothing good that ever happens to you or me which will not eventually go bad. And that we have to lose eventually. There ain't nothing, you know, except for Dharma practice. There's just nothing. Your health, good looks if you have or had any, strength, intelligence, ability to see, hear, taste, smell, ability to walk to your car, any kind of relationships you might have, anything you own, any kind of career you might have, any kind of loved ones you have. You have to lose all of them, period. You know, inevitably, you have to lose everything. And it's just a matter of time. It's just a question of where and when. You must lose it all. That's Gyurwe Dunya. And it's so obvious, and we kind of don't admit it. You know, we just consciously, I think, try to block it out. It's like death or something like that. I mean, if I say, are you going to die? You say, yeah, someday. But we just kind of mentally block it out. And this thing here, you just totally block it out. I mean, nobody goes around saying, I'm getting up to go to a job that I have to lose in order to earn money that I have to give away, in a body that has to get old and die, in order to buy a house that I'm going to lose, for my kids who are going to die and get separated from me. You know, they don't say that. Most people don't say that. But it's just, that's the way it is. That's Gyurwe Dunya. And you don't have to be a Buddhist to admit it. It's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. You have to try to do something about it. Third kind of suffering. Say, Kyaba. Dujegi. Dunya. Kyaba. Dujegi. Dunya. Kyaba means, covers over something like the shade of this tree is almost covering everybody here. Not quite, sorry. That's called Kyaba. Kyaba means to cover or to cover over something completely. Like pervasive. Okay? Pervasive. Duce means all-inclusive. Okay? And Dunyao means suffering. This is a very special kind of suffering. Like there are beings in other realms that they don't have outright suffering. They don't have suffering number one. And they can live for a long time, and the pleasure in their realm is not changing as quickly as it does here. But this one is everywhere, and this refers to the nature of your own body, the nature of your own life. Okay? The nature of your body is to get old and die. I mean, the nature, there's something innately inside your being which is suffering. We talked about a dinner and we talked about a headache. But Kyaba Dujegi Dunya, the example is you. The example is you. Your body and your mind must get old and they must die. Okay? They're automatically, from the moment you get them, from the moment of conception, from the moment that the sperm hits the egg, it starts to get old. It starts to age. And it starts to lose its strength and vitality. It must. It always will. That's pervasive suffering. You can't escape it. It's everywhere. Because it's walking along with you. Because it's you. Your body and your mind are like that. You must suffer. And the body must degenerate and get worse. We talked about it last night. According to Buddhism, you don't need an outer factor for something to be destroyed. The body will take care of destroying itself quite nicely. Okay? You don't have to get hit by a car. You don't have to get mugged and shot. You don't have to catch a disease. The body will kill itself. If you kept the body in a nice, quiet room, and people brought food for it every afternoon, you know, and took care of it, and all you had to do was sleep and eat and poop, it would still kill itself. The body would still kill itself. It's just the nature of the body. Jetsam Khapa, when he talks about death meditation, he talks about the elements of the body. There are different energies in the body. There's energies that cool the body. There's energies that keep the body warm. There's energies that keep the body still when it has to be still. There's energies that keep it moving when it has to be moving. And all those four energies are fighting against each other. There's one energy that's trying to keep your body cooled down far enough that you don't get sick. There's another energy that's trying to keep it warm enough that they don't put you in the morgue. You know, and there's these four energies working in the body. They reach a state of balance very rarely. It's unusual and it's an anomaly, and that's called health. Okay, I translated for the Yeshe Din Dalai Lama's doctor like 20 years ago, and he started to go into this long reason, explanation of why, when all the four elements are balanced, it's a mistake, and health is an unusual and temporary circumstance, and that the normal human condition is for one of them to be out of whack. If one gets out of whack enough, you get a fever. If it gets more imbalanced, you get dead. And that's just the nature of the body. There are four forces working inside the body. They are working for opposite goals. And sooner or later, one of them will overwhelm the other. And you'll either get a fever and die, or you'll get pneumonia and die, in the case of the ones that take care of heating and cooling. So those are like opposite energies. And sooner or later, one of them will become more powerful. Your body is a time bomb. Your body is going to kill itself. Your body is made of four energies that are fighting each other every day, and sooner or later one of them will get the upper hand and you'll die. It'll shut down the other one and you'll die. So your own body is killing yourself. This is Kyaba Duche Kidunya. This is the nature of this suffering. It's going on as we speak. Those are the three kinds of suffering. This is, if you hear these three and you study them well, you get what we call renunciation. If you get true renunciation, you reach the first path that we talked about this morning, Soglam. You reach the path of accumulation. That is to reach the path of accumulation. Now there's something very interesting. If you take that same realization and you focus it towards other people's situations, if you say, oh, it's not just my body, it's her body and his body and his body. They all have the same problem that I have. They all have these three sufferings too. If you just take that same realization and focus it outwards towards other people, then that state of renunciation becomes the... what? It's bodhicitta, okay. So really, you reach the first path of the five in the Mahayana track if you take that renunciation and just focus it on other people too. So really, reaching the first path of the Mahayana track and reaching the first path of the Hinayana track is the same state of mind. What? I'm fed up with this, okay? And I don't think you have to be so philosophical about it. You know, Nyanjung, or the state of renunciation, it's just this naturally being unhappy with the way things are going. And it doesn't take a big effort, you know? you know, it's very simple. I think almost everybody has some form of renunciation. And that's why we struggle. That's why we try to be happy. That's why we get up in the morning and try to do something. You know, you get out of bed because you think something's going to happen to make you happy. Otherwise, you'd stay in bed, and there are people who stay in bed. You know, like in mental wards or something. They just stay in bed because they can't imagine anything good coming out of getting up today. But that drive to try, I mean, the drive to do anything, the drive to do the smallest thing, to move out of the sun, to go away from the bug, you know, these are all renunciation. You just want to be happy. And you want to get out of this way of life. This way of life where everything screws up all the time. And it will. You know, it doesn't take a genius to get to the path of accumulation. It just be unhappy. Just be unhappy with the way it's going. And we have that. It's automatic. I think everybody has it. That's why you try to live. That's why you try to do some kind of work, or you try to get something, but those are just wrong ways of doing it. But the motivation, I think, is pretty close to renunciation. You're just unhappy. You're not satisfied. There's something going wrong. And that's renunciation. When you turn it around and imagine that everybody else in the world is going through the same problem, and everybody else in the world is suffering because they can't find how to fix things, It's very natural to have bodhicitta. It's not, I don't think it's such a big deal. It's just to recognize that other people are having as lousy a life as you are, okay? And try to think of how you could help them, you know? And that's bodhicitta. So the first Buddha's answer is like this. He said, you should have bodhicitta towards all other people. You should focus on enlightenment, which he calls nirvana or total nirvana. And he says, and you should do that for other people. Okay, in the short term, we talked about it last night. The word for nirvana, I'll give it to you, then we'll take a break. This is the Tibetan word for nirvana. Say nyangen len depa. Nyangen len depa. If you're wondering where the na comes from, it's the prenasal of the o. But you'll figure it out someday. Nyangen means grief. Okay, nyangen means grief, and it really is exactly grief. Like nowadays in Tibetan, when you're in the monastery and somebody's mother dies, and you say, "Oh, don't too have too much nyangen." Okay, don't worry too much. Don't have too much nyangen. Nyangen literally means grief. Le means from. Depa means to go beyond. So nyangen le depa, the Tibetan word for nirvana, means to go beyond grief. Okay, to transcend grief. Grief in this sense has three parts. Grief. Say nyomo.
Nyomo.
Nyomo means it's translated as mental affliction. Okay, mental affliction. The Sanskrit word is klesha, and you get a feeling of what it means because klesha comes from a root klish. Klish means to aggravate somebody, to disturb somebody, to bother somebody. It means to be distressed. These are the root meanings of klesh. So it really is mental affliction in the sense that they are bugging you, they are bothering you, and the definition of it is sem mishur chepe, sem chung, which means it's ruining your peace of mind. It's any thought, any state of mind, which is ruining your peace of mind, disturbing your peace of mind. If it's a root mental affliction, it's ruining it in many different ways for the whole day or for a long period. There are six of those. If it's a minor mental affliction, of which there are 20, it's bothering you from a specific angle for a specific amount of time. And then there are 84,000 variations, okay? But basically 26 mental afflictions. These are all the thoughts that are keeping you unhappy. Anytime your mind is not at peace, not happy, healthy, serene, you've got a nyomo going on. Okay. One or more. Okay. One or a combination. Those are nyomos. That's the first part of grief. When we say nirvana consists of getting out of grief or going beyond grief, the first thing is that you're getting out of your mental affliction. Okay. I won't even give you the list. You can identify them. Anything that bothers you mentally, anything that ruins your peace of mind, anything that makes you the slightest bit unhappy or dissatisfied is nyomo. Okay, it's a nyomo. Nyomos lead you to take actions in order to fix things. They make you unhappy, so you got to do something to fix things. If it's anger, you got to say something to somebody. If it's desire, you got to chase something. If it's jealousy, you have to be unhappy about someone else's success. Okay, and that leads to le. Say le.
Le.
Le. In Sanskrit. Karma. Karma, okay. Karma means action, doing something, ignorant action. Okay, doing something stupid because a nyomo got into your mind and you decided it would be good to get rid of this guy by saying something bad to him. Or it would be good to get this girl by chasing her and hurting her husband or something like that. And these are all lay. They're all motivated by the nyomos, by the mental afflictions, desire, anger, jealousy, like that. That's the second part of the grief that you escape when you reach nirvana. Okay, nirvana is defined as escaping from those two and the three sufferings that we just went through. Okay. The three sufferings. So nirvana in its most basic sense means, and it's defined as, Nyundit malupa pambe sosa tango. You should say it just for good luck, okay? Nyundit malupa pambe sosa tango. Which means, eliminating all your mental afflictions permanently. Because of the realizations you had after you saw emptiness directly. Okay? Eliminating your mental afflictions, all of them, permanently. Nyendit malupa pangba. Sosot pango. Because of the realizations that you had following your direct perception of emptiness. Okay? That's the definition of nirvana. What's the difference between nirvana and Buddhahood? And then we'll take a break. That's close. I mean, if I reach nirvana, if I define nirvana as getting out of the mental afflictions permanently, if I reach that tonight, would I change? Would you still see me here? I mean, yeah, okay. Would I still have this kind of a body with blood and guts and lymph nodes and all that stuff? No, that's what I'm asking. The difference between nirvana and Buddhahood. Okay, what's the difference between nirvana and Buddhahood? Nirvana is simply the absence of the mental afflictions. It's overcoming the bad parts of your mind permanently. It doesn't say anything about your body. It doesn't say anything about the suffering that's going on around you. It doesn't say anything about your relationships or your house or your family or anything else. That's still suffering. Those things are still going to be screwy. And I guarantee you they will. Okay? They will still mess up all the time. We spend our whole life doing damage control, you know? That won't change. Life will continue to change and mess up constantly. You don't have any choice. But mentally, what? You won't have that those mental afflictions. But you won't have those emotions about it. Okay. You won't respond in a bad way. You won't collect new karma, but you still got old karma. The day when you clean out your old karma. Totally. Then under the influence of ultimate compassion, then you reach what's called total nirvana, which is the same thing as Buddhahood. So there's a big difference between nirvana and Buddhahood. Okay. Nirvana is simply eliminating your mental afflictions permanently, which can only be done by seeing emptiness directly. Buddhahood is when you go further and further on, and then the rest of your world straightens out. The physical world around you becomes a paradise. The beings around you become holy angels. And your own body changes and becomes what we call a rainbow body. It changes its nature completely. And then you reach what's called total enlightenment. And that is freedom from all three sufferings. You don't have any of those three sufferings anymore. Okay. Yeah.
One question. You had said earlier that once you, even if you've seen emptiness directly and you attain this lower nirvana, that you could still act out of your affliction.
Oh.
And that would be creating more negative karma.
There's a debate about it. Lucha Dhammabhadra, who's an important lama of the Vajragini lineage, I was just reading his, one of his students asked him this question, and they recorded it. They carved it. And he said, yeah, that's true. If you've reached the lower nirvana, you still have the capacity for certain kinds of mental afflictions. Technically, nirvana is escaping all your mental afflictions permanently. And they make a distinction between Shinje and Shinje Mayimba, which means mental afflictions that chain you to this life and mental afflictions that don't chain you to this life, but they exist in the form of a potential. So you don't lose the latter until you reach just before enlightenment, eighth bodhisattva level, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. What I mean is, if you didn't have mental afflictions, you wouldn't react to people negatively. Even if people hurt you, or even if things didn't work out in your relationships or in your life, you wouldn't respond with anger or hatred. Because of that, you wouldn't collect new karma for new suffering. But like this body was produced by karma that was definitely committed before December 17th, 1952, when I was conceived, you know what I mean, or born or whatever. I mean, this body is a projection continuing on from events that happened before I was born. And until that wears out, this body won't die. This body won't change. So even if tonight I reached nirvana and I overcame anger in its every form, even down to the slightest irritation, my body would still be here the next morning, because it's been projected by my former karma. But at least I won't collect any new bad deeds.
Mm-hmm. What you said earlier, though, is that even if you perceive entities correctly, you would still have negative karma rising, but when you answer the question about whether you would act out of karma, you would.
That's why there's the fourth path. The fourth path consists of the many years that it takes after you see emptiness directly to finish off your mental afflictions. Yeah, when you see emptiness directly, you only destroy, we talked about it last night, 1.5 mental afflictions permanently. You can never doubt Buddhism again. You saw your future life directly, you saw the Buddha directly. Well, who's going to tell you anything? You know, you got somebody going to convince you that there's no future life. You know what your future lives are. You know certain details of your future life. You know when you're going to die. You know what the Buddha looks like. And you know you're not crazy. So, after seeing emptiness directly, during the period immediately following, within the next 24 hours. So who's going to talk you out of Buddhism? You know, it's like knowing the lottery numbers for next year, you know. And who's going to talk you out of Buddhism? You lose the capacity to doubt this path. But that's the only mental affliction you lose permanently in its entirety, and that's doubt about Buddhism. That whole path of habituation, which can take 7 lifetimes, typically 7, is full of fighting the mental afflictions and using the knowledge that you gain to destroy them. Okay. And that's a long job. In the Mahayana track, up to the 8th Bodhisattva level, you're fighting them, and you're still doing bad things. Yeah.
Do the three lower vehicles, the hearer and solitary realizer, have a final state?
They say tatu tekpa chik. There's a big debate in the monastery, you know. They say tatu tekpa suma, tatu tekpa chik. In other words, are there three tracks or is there only one track? Meaning, if you start on one of those two Hinayana tracks, you eventually have to go up to Mahayana track anyway. So in that sense, there'd be only one track, really, and maybe three ways to get onto it. And the ultimate tajja, the ultimate decision in the scriptures is that, yeah, I mean, from that point of view, there's only one track, really. You can get onto it three different ways, but sooner or later, everybody has to go to Mahayana track. So he called tatu tekpa chik, which means ultimately there's only one track. Ultimately, there's only one jhana. Okay, from that point of view. Big debate. Okay, take a break, and we'll come back in like, what time is it now? What do you want to say? 4:30? That's not enough. I'll say 4:30 if you agree to go to 5:15. Yeah. Okay. Okay. 4:30 and take a break. The next section's a little hard because we've got to figure out why nobody reaches nirvana, and that's going to take a while. Okay. I'll give you a true scenario that happened to me the other day. You're in a restaurant. And this is a New York restaurant, very expensive. And you're eating there, and you all eat big lunch. And then the bill comes. Everybody looks around, you know. And I usually get it. And you whip out your wallet with a flare, and you open it up, and it's empty. You realize the emptiness of your wallet. Okay? That's a very concrete example. And that's very... serious. That's a very serious example. Why? Empty means empty. Empty of something. Something's missing. Empty means missing. The word in Tibetan is tongba. Tongba nyi. Say tongba nyi.
Tongba nyi.
And tongba nyi implies that there. You thought something was there and it wasn't there. I mean, that's what emptiness implies, right? Emptiness means there was supposed to be something in the wallet, but it ain't there. And that's emptiness. That's emptiness implies that something you thought was there isn't there. Okay? Something you thought was there is not there. Like, bucks. So, that's emptiness. I mean, emptiness implies the missing of something. Something missing. Something's not there. Okay? When we talk about emptiness in Buddhism, philosophically, what's the thing that's missing? What's the thing that you thought was there but ain't there? It has many, many words, you know. I'll call it self-existent thing, okay? I mean, there's many words you can use. I'm going to call it a self-existent thing, okay? Something you thought was there that ain't there. And therefore, you come up empty. And that's exactly what emptiness means. Something you thought was there is not there, and that's emptiness, okay? Self-existent thing. We have a name for the self-existent thing. Say, gotcha.
Gotcha.
Gotcha is going to become your old friend, okay? Gotcha is going to become one of your most intimate friends in Buddhism. You have to know gotcha. Shantideva said, Tate nula marikpa, de ngume jimayin. Until you understand what gotcha is, you will never understand emptiness. Until you understand what a dollar bill is, you'll never know what emptiness of your wallet means. Okay? You have to understand what it is that's missing. You know, what's missing? Gotcha means to deny something. Gotcha means the thing we deny. It's the thing in Buddhism we say doesn't exist. It's a self-existent thing. Okay? A self-existent thing. This is the classic self-existent thing. When you go looking for it, you come up empty, and then you've perceived emptiness. Okay? But you have to know what you thought was there in order to find out that it's not there. Okay? You have to be able to identify. Shantideva says, you must identify the gotcha in order to establish that it ain't there. You have to know what a dollar bill looks like before you can realize the emptiness of your wallet. Okay? You have to know what it was like that you were looking for before you can figure out that it ain't there. Okay? And that's gotcha. Gotcha is a self-existent thing. Okay? Gotcha is a self-existent thing. Does it exist? No. Yeah. It's the object to be denied. The object which we deny. Okay. Gok means refute, stop, deny. Okay. The object that we deny. And the tricky part is that it doesn't exist anyway. So how do you identify something that doesn't even exist? You see what I mean? I mean, it's not like a dollar bill in that sense. It's like a dollar bill that never existed in the first place. It's like looking for money that you never had in your wallet anyway. Okay. The tricky thing about gotcha is it's very difficult. You're trying to identify a self-existent thing that you think is there, which never was there. And can't be there. Because it doesn't even exist. Okay, so in the first place you have to understand gotcha doesn't even exist. A self-existent thing is crazy. There's no such thing. We are constantly living in a world where we think things are self-existent. But they don't. That thing doesn't exist. A self-existent thing doesn't even exist. So really what we're talking about identifying is your imagination of a self-existent thing. It's called gotcha chi. Say chi. Chi means that mental image of a self-existent thing. Does that exist? Yeah, can you imagine a two-headed elephant? You can. Does it exist? No. But the imagination exists. Like you can picture in your mind an elephant with two heads. But if you go out looking for one, you won't find it. And when you establish that there are no two-headed elephants in Vajrapani Institute, you can say, this place is empty of two-headed elephants. Okay? Which never existed anyway. So the tricky thing about gotcha, self-existent thing, it can't exist anyway. It's just a silly thing. It can't exist. It can't exist. Your imagination of it does exist. And in fact, it is the root of all suffering. Okay? Your picture of it in your mind does exist. And that is the root of all suffering. Okay? What would a self-existent thing be like? Well, it would not depend on anything else. Okay? It does not depend on anything else. Okay? So we can say it's not dependent. Something that's not dependent on anything else. When you say no self, no self exists, you're talking about gotcha. Okay? What is a self-existent thing? This is where people get in trouble. If you get over the next half hour, you'll be okay. All right? You got to stick with it the next. It's good that it got a little cool. You have to identify what a self-existent thing would be like. Okay? And you have to identify all the wrong ideas about gotcha. Because there's more wrong ideas than right ideas. There's about a million wrong ideas about a self-existent thing. And there's only one right idea about a self-existent thing. The silliest and wrongest wrong idea is that I don't even exist. Okay? Is what you see up here talking the gotcha? Okay? It's crazy to say that's a gacha, because you can see me and you're not crazy. Okay? You have what we call sema or pramana. You have a correct perception. I am up here talking, and I am a person, and I do function, and you are learning something. Because I function, because you're learning something, because you're perceiving me and you're not crazy or drugged out or anything else, I exist. That's the definition of existence in Buddhism. I do exist. This guy up here is not the gacha. In other words, when we talk about emptiness, we are not denying that you exist. That would be silly. Jim wouldn't have to be cleaning out the cesspool if you didn't exist. It's very simple. Go tell him you don't exist. You know, I mean, that's crazy, but many people think that. I mean, you are making a basic mistake perceptually. There's something going on that you are grasping to a self-existent thing, but it ain't the thing standing up here in front of you. I function, I work, I'm teaching you, and you're also functioning, and you're functioning very well. And no one can say anything else, you know. That's silly. That's crazy. So emptiness does not mean emptiness of the things that you can see. These are here. We're here. That's silly. We are here. And what good would it do to say you're not here? Is that going to make your mental affliction stop? You know, is that going to make you a kinder person to say you don't exist? You know, it's silly. It's a crazy idea. So that's not the gacha. But identifying the gacha is very difficult. It's very difficult. What is it that we think is there that's not there, that's screwing us up and causing all our suffering? You know, how does that work? Why is that? You know, according to the higher schools of Buddhism, Madhyamika Prasangika, you have never had a correct perception in your life until the time you perceive emptiness directly. Okay? You've never had an accurate perception in your entire life until the day you perceive emptiness directly. Okay? Every other perception has been infected by some kind of wrong perception. Okay? And you don't know it until you reach the path of seeing that you have never had a correct perception. Something's going on with gacha. We have to identify what's the gacha. Okay? By the way, what's the opposite of gacha? Gacha means something that's not dependent. Okay? Gacha means something that's not dependent. This is what you hear, this is what it means when you hear about dependent origination. Okay? If something was a gacha, it would have to be something that did not have dependent origination. Okay? If there were an object in the universe that did not have dependent origination, that would be a gacha, and that would be a self-existent object. I have to say that would be, because it's impossible. Okay, if there was anything in the universe that was not dependently created, then that thing would be a self-existent object. Okay, that would be a self-existent object. So to understand gacha and to understand emptiness, first you have to understand what. What is dependent origination? Yeah. What does it mean to depend on something else? Because it's the opposite of that, which is self-existence. And it's the lack of self-existence, which is called emptiness. We'll go through that again. Okay? Everything in the universe is dependent. Okay? If you ever found a thing that wasn't dependent, it would be a gacha, a self-existent thing. And the emptiness of those things in the world, the fact that those don't exist, is emptiness. Okay? Everything depends on something else. If you ever found anything that didn't depend on something else, that would be a self-existent thing or a gacha. And the general lack of gachas all over the place is called emptiness. And that's simple. That's simple? Anyway. So to understand emptiness, you've got to understand first what? Gacha. But to understand gacha, you've got to understand what dependent means. What is the meaning of dependent? Okay. And we'll go through that real quick. Okay. Remember, again, self-existent thing is going to be something which is not like what I'm about to describe. Okay, I'm going to describe dependent things now. I'm going to talk about what does dependent mean. The lowest schools of Buddhism say dependent means depends on its causes. Depends on its causes and conditions to start or to grow. That's what dependent means. Depending on other things means everything depends on its causes. That's what dependence means. That's what dependent origination means. What would the gacha be in that case? Something that didn't depend on its causes. Something that existed, but didn't depend on its causes. They say sky flower. They say a flower that could germinate, sprout, spread its petals, and give its sweet perfume in midair. No soil, no water, no sunlight. Just in midair, this flower starts to grow. That's what they call Namke Metto. That's an example. Okay. If you could take, if suddenly a cucumber could grow in front of you, in air, in empty space, right in front of you, without any water, without any seed, without any farmer, without any sunlight or earth, that would be a gotcha. Okay. Now, do you have a problem with that kind of thing? Are you constantly distressed or disturbed by cucumbers growing in the air around you? You know, I mean, is this causing you a lot of suffering? You know, I mean, is this? Do you have gotchas like that that are ruining your life? And that are causing the three kinds of suffering for you, you know? No, I mean, I used to get really disturbed by this thing, you know? But I don't have a problem with flowers growing in space around me. It doesn't happen, you know? So what's the point, you know? So what? So the trees around Vajrapani had seeds and they had sunlight. I understand that. I don't have a problem with that. That's not making me suffer. You know, I don't get it. I don't believe in gotchas. I don't think that, you know, a redwood is going to grow in the middle of the driveway and will have a problem without a seed, without any growth period, without any watering. You know, I don't have a problem like that. That doesn't make my life terrible. I didn't get it. You know, I mean, if that's what dependent origination means, and if the opposite of that is something that could grow without any seeds, so I don't see the point. You know, I'm not holding on to that all my life. You know, I'm not going around telling people, you know, watch out, there might be a redwood grew in the driveway while we were having a, you know, class, you know. It's not a problem. The higher schools say to the lower schools, come on, not everything has to have seeds. For example, there is space itself, okay? Space itself, empty space, exists. If empty space didn't exist, I wouldn't have a place to be right now. I'd have to move over. Okay? If there wasn't empty space right there, I couldn't be there. Okay? There's always empty space next to me, and I can move into it. Does the empty space go away? No, it's occupied, but it doesn't go away. And when I move out of it, it's not occupied anymore. And when I move into it, it's occupied again. But empty space is always there. I mean, the planet Earth can disappear. The sun can melt. Everything can go away. Empty space will still be there. Empty space does not have causes. It does not grow. It did not start. It will not end. It doesn't change. It doesn't change. It doesn't depend on seeds or any kind of growth process. It's just there. So the higher schools say to the lower schools, that can't be what dependence means. That can't be what dependent origination means. And I was glad when I found that out, because I was really frustrated. Lamas telling me, everything's caused, therefore everything's empty. So what? You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. And it doesn't make me happier to find out that everything has a seed. I mean, it didn't change my life. It is one meaning of dependent origination. It's not the ultimate meaning of dependent origination. So what do the next schools say? The next group of schools, they say dependent origination means that everything has its parts. Everything depends on its parts. You know, that's a little more subtle. That makes more sense. Okay? Everything depends on its parts. And that's what dependent origination means. That's what what the middle schools say. Okay? They say everything is dependently originating because it depends on its parts. In that case, the gotcha would be what? Something that didn't depend on its parts. Something that could exist without parts. And there ain't nothing like that. Everything has parts. Okay? Even empty space has east, west, north, south, up, down. Even empty space has parts. Okay? So in that sense, it's dependent. It is dependent. It comes into existence. It exists through dependence. Okay? So what? I mean, is that going to stop my suffering? It's okay. Everything is like those models I used to build when I was a kid. They all have parts. So what's the point? You know, I mean, I still didn't get it. You know, I'm still saying, so okay, I admit that every object in the world has parts, and they all depend on their parts. And if there was something in the world that didn't have parts, that would be a gotcha. But I don't have a problem with that. I don't go around obsessing on things that don't have parts, you know, and it doesn't make me suffer. I don't get the point. I don't see how understanding that is going to help me at all. Then the higher school comes along, Madhyamika Prasangika, the higher school of Buddhism. They say that's not the ultimate meaning of dependence. That's not what dependence means. They say something much more subtle. They say dependence means depends on your own projection. Every object in the universe depends on your own projection. Its existence depends on your projection. The existence of every single object in the universe depends on your projection. In that case, what would the gotchot be? Something that didn't depend on your projection. Something that could exist without your projection. Now you're getting interesting. Okay, now it gets interesting. I mean, I couldn't get those other ones. And they're not complete. They're not comprehensive. This one is. Every object in the universe depends on your projection. Okay? It could not exist without your projection. If you want to go find a self-existent thing, if you were looking for the gotcha, try to imagine something that could exist without your personal projection. Try to find something in your experience that could exist without your projections being involved. And that's the ultimate meaning of gotcha. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it. Object which we deny. No. We're going to spend the whole class on that. I mean, the whole week on that. So don't worry, we'll get there. Tiny and back, man. We'll talk about it. This should be your next mantra. Okay? This is Madhyamika mantra. I'm going to change it a bit. I tried to make it short, but it doesn't sound the same. First I'll talk about what projection means. Okay, what does projection mean? It means the following. The way in which you and I perceive anything, the way in which we perceive anything. In Yankee Stadium, they wait for the jet to go over. The way in which you and I can ever be aware of anything is that our eyes or our minds, they select certain parts of an object. Your eyes are always going like this. You know, your eyes are skipping around like this. And they see a corner of black. They see an edge of some other color. They see a little bit of red here. They can't see the whole face at once. Impossible. Okay? Impossible. They are taking data from the face. They're saying, curve, there's a line there, there's two holes there, two black spots. You know, it's going like that. It's picking up data. And then it synthesizes it. It says face. Okay. It takes those data. It takes those clues, and it makes a perfect mental image of that thing. And then it calls it face, human face. Okay. You never see a face. Forget it. You never are seeing a face. You cannot see a whole face. Once you're looking at the face, you're going to miss the parts. Once you miss the parts, you can't see it anymore. How can you see a face without seeing two eyes and a nose? If you're looking at two eyes and a nose, how can you see a face? What you're doing is impossible. What you think you're doing is impossible. You can't see a face. You're either seeing two eyes and a nose, or like that, but you can't see a whole face. Forget it, it's impossible. You're picking up data. You're picking up clues. Okay? When you see a human face, it's because you picked up two straight parts, two roundish parts, two black spots there, a little bit round. And then your mind creates a nice face out of it. And then your mind says, face. Okay? Really, you never see a face. You never see a whole face. You can't. You are seeing clues of a face. It's Picasso. And Picasso really understood it. You know, get in the essentials and the mind fills in face. Okay? You see in your a face. You think you're seeing a face. What you're seeing is your own mental image that's synthesized from certain clues. And on that you project faith. Okay. You get certain clues, your eye picks up certain colors, shapes, and says, then your mind makes a nice mental image, and you call that image faith. Okay. So by the time it's all over, all you're ever seeing is this mental image in your own mind of a thing called faith. And you're naming that faith. That's what projection means. That's the process by which you go. And that is the ultimate meaning of dependent origination. That is dependent origination. It's the process of picking up data, making a nice mental image, and calling it faith.
Okay.
And that's what they mean when they say imputation, that's what they mean when they say nominal, that's what they mean with all of that. You are picking up certain clues, you are forming a faith in your mind, and you mistake that faith for a faith that really exists out there.
Mm-hmm.
You are constantly mistaking that image in your mind for a faith which exists out there. And you think there's a faith out there that's nice, perfect faith by itself. It's not. You are picking up certain clues, and you're calling it faith. When you think about the process, it's impossible. You can't see the face without looking at the eyes and the nose and the mouth. When you're looking at the eyes and the nose and the mouth, you can't be looking at the face. It's impossible. What you think you're doing is impossible. It's so simple that you miss it. You can't see a face without seeing the parts. When you look at the parts, you can't see the face. It's impossible. What you think you're doing is totally impossible. It's obvious, but you're constantly doing it. You're constantly thinking, these parts are this thing by themselves.
Okay.
These things are inherently a faith.
Okay.
But what's really happening is that you're seeing some clues and you're getting a mental image based on those clues, and you mistake the mental image for a faith which exists out there independently. Independent of your own projection. That's gotcha. A faith which could exist in theory, okay? I have to say in theory. A faith which could exist in theory, out there, independent of me synthesizing it into a nice mental image and calling it faith, is impossible. It don't exist. All the faces that you see when you look around, outside of yourself, seemingly independent of your mind, don't exist. There's no such thing. We'll talk about it. We got a long... You can say label, it's okay. Label is fine. You're taking a group of parts, you're conceiving them as a whole, and then you are naming it or labeling it or imputing it. I don't care what you call it. The whole process I call projection. It's projection. It's called Thakpa. Tane Thakpa.
Mm-hmm.
That whole process is called projection. That is the ultimate meaning of dependent origination. Based on my explanation, you can't perceive it right now. There will come a day at the end of the path of preparation when you perceive it directly. You'll be standing there looking at a pot and realizing this can't be what I think it is. This is not outside of my own projection. This is not outside of my own mental imaging. That pot don't exist on that stove. It exists in my own mind.
Okay.
There'll come a day when you see that directly. On that day, you have grasped dependent origination. You live in dependent origination. Your whole world is dependent origination. But until that day, you don't know what dependent origination really is. And on that day, you grasp it. You see it directly. You understand that you cannot be seeing this pot as it seems. It cannot exist out there on the stove like that. I am only seeing my own mental image of a pot based on some colors and shapes that I saw. And that's dependent origination. Did you perceive emptiness? No.
Mm-hmm.
Did you perceive emptiness? No. You perceived dependent origination. You perceived what it is for something to be dependent. You live in that world. Everything in your world exists that way, but you don't recognize what's going on until that final stage of the path of preparation, the second path. It takes a lot of work to get there. On that day, you see it directly.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go into meditation, and you see that nothing in the world is not that way. Double negative is very important in studying emptiness. Okay? It's hard. Nothing in the world is not that way. There ain't anything in the world which is not like that. And that's emptiness. Emptiness is the fact that there ain't anything in the world which is not my own projection. There isn't anything. Somebody will say, does that mean nothing exists? You know? Then you have to think about it.
Right.
Like, how do I see a face? I see two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, and I call it faith. I project onto it faith.
Okay.
How do I see the eye? Same way. I see the left side of the eye and the right side of the eye and the middle of the eye, and I glue it all together in my mind and call it eye. Okay, how do I see the left side of the eye? Huh? Same thing. I see the left side of the left side of the eye and the right side of the left side of the eye and the middle of the left side of the eye, and I call that the left side of the eye. Now, what about the left side of the left side of the eye?
Does this come from meditative experience or not perception of the body?
You need both. You need both. Both have to come together. They have to cooperate with each other. Okay. And this is what this means. This is the mantra of a Madhyamika Prasangika. Say, Tanye, Sakte, Sakten, Sawe Sena, Minye. Tanye, Sakte, Sakten, Sawe Sena, Minye. This is how to get to emptiness. How do you get to emptiness? Okay. Tanye means idea or name. Tanye means idea or name. We can say label. Maybe label's the best thing. Label. Okay. Let's call it the label face, for example. Okay. Sakpe Taktun means the thing you gave the label. The thing you gave the label. Okay? The thing to which you gave the label. The object to which you gave the label. Selwe Sena. Selwe Sena means when you look for it. When you go looking for it. Okay? When you go on an exploring trip. When you go on an investigation mentally to go find the object which you are labeling. Okay? Minye. Minye means you ain't gonna find anything. Minye means you can't find anything. You'll never find it. And what you come up with is emptiness. Okay, it's cool. Okay? You go on a search for a two-headed elephant around Vrajapani. You go to the left, you go to the right, up, down, everywhere. You don't find it. You found the emptiness of elephant, two-headed elephant. Okay? That is the trip. That is the process. Okay? We'll talk about it. But the point here is that when you go looking for the thing that you labeled, you'll never find anything. And if you keep doing that long enough, you'll come up with zero. That's emptiness. Okay. What does that mean? Okay, what does that mean? Okay, let's start with a face. Okay. If you go try to find a face that doesn't depend on your own perception. Okay, let's go try to find a face that can exist without this process of you taking parts and calling them face. Okay? So, we gotta leave out the person calling them face. We're just looking for the parts, okay? And I ask you, is two oval shapes and two straight lines and a bigger oval always a face? Is it self-existently, inherently a face? You know, if I put two lines here, you know, and one here and an oval here, is that a face? No. Okay, until you call it face, it is not a face. Until you project onto it face, it ain't a face. Two lines, two round things, two smaller black things, and one round thing here is not a face by itself. That's a gotcha. Okay. A face that could exist without my participation. Just two lines, two smaller ovals, two black holes, and one bigger red hole. It's not a face. Until I call it face. Until I think of it as a face and call it a face. Okay. Gotcha is a face that could exist without me participating in it. What about the eye? The eyeball. You know, is it the same? I mean, you can keep going down infinitely. And that's Tani Tapir Dakin Sawetena Minye. You can go down infinitely. You can keep looking for an eyeball which is an eyeball by itself. You can keep looking for a part of an eyeball which is part of an eyeball by itself. You can keep looking for a face which is a face by itself without your own participation or your own projection, and you'll never find it. You can't find it. You keep coming up with zero. You keep coming up empty. That's the process of locating emptiness. And that's the meditation that you do. You can keep looking for it, you'll never find it. You keep looking for a two-headed elephant, you cover all of Vrajapani. I mean, they have a certain size, right? So if it's here, it's got to be a certain size. I mean, you don't need a microscope to do this examination. You know it's got to be like 3 yards long or something. So it's pretty restricted. You cover every area in Vrajapani that's 3 yards long. If you don't find a two-headed elephant, then what? It's empty. Then they don't exist. They really don't exist. The trick is that you're looking for something that never existed in the first place. That's the first trick. a self-existent me never existed in the first place. So it's going to be a little hard to establish that it's not there, because it never existed anyway. Okay, that's the first difficult part. Exactly. I mean, we're on the last part of the Buddha's answer. Okay, who achieves nirvana? What's that guy like? You know, I swear, you know, I swear to take all sentient beings to enlightenment. Final nirvana. Who? You know, who? Who are you going to take to nirvana? You know, is it this guy that's existing outside of your own mind, outside of your own projection? Because if that's it, nobody's going to get there. There's no such thing. There is no such thing. There ain't nobody. You ain't going to get nobody to nirvana because there's nobody like that. That's a gotcha. That's a self-existent person. Okay. What's that got to do with reaching enlightenment? I mean, we still didn't answer this question. It used to bother me for years and years. Okay. Tom Wagoner is my projection. So big deal. I mean, what's that help me? You know, what's that do for me? You know, I mean, how's that change my life? He's still there. He's still the same as he was before. I mean, who cares if he's part of my mind or not? You know, I can still talk to him. We can still have a good time. We can still go out, see a movie. You know, we can still do anything. So what's the point? What's the difference? You know, how does that help me? What's the use of seeing that something is not other than my projection? Why do I have to sit there and analyze Michael's eyes and his ears and his nose and his everything? So who cares? You know, what's the point? How's that going to help me? We have to think about that. We have to talk about that. But first of all, what is the gata? What is Madhyamika denying? What does the Diamond Sutra say doesn't exist? Who's the person that you can't get to nirvana? It's a self-existent person. What is he or she like? She is independent of my projection. She exists out there without my mind saying, oh, that's a person, because all those parts I glue together and think of as a person. Okay. That kind of person is self-existent. That kind of person doesn't exist. Now, what's that got to do with your life? You know, what's that got to do with reaching nirvana yourself? How does that help? We're going to talk about that all during the course. That's going to be the point of the whole course. Okay? The process of reaching emptiness is to go on the search for the two-headed elephant in all the places where the two-headed elephant could be. Okay? Go look for a thing that could exist out there, independent of your mind, independent of your projection, and you won't find anything. Okay? You can go down level after level. You know, look for a face that's independent. Look for an eye that's independent. Look for the part of the eye that's independent. You won't find it. Mm-hmm. You won't get to it. When you finally get tired and run out of places to look, you've reached emptiness. You've perceived emptiness. Mm-hmm. It all seems very intellectual. It all seems very impractical. It all seems very much, you know, like BS in a philosophy class in college. And now the next job we have to do is to relate it to your real life. You know, what's it got to do with your real life? Why is that important?